the same with tuberculosis. So the rationale for the initial inclusion was very weak.
Okay, great. Thank you. I have to apologize also for the title of this. I don't know what happened, but my Spanglish took over and came up with that. Doesn't read very well. As others, I have some disclosures, and including DSM-5. Rett syndrome is a very interesting disorder. It has a very distinctive and unique developmental profile. It's still diagnosed on the basis of clinical features. And I'm going to mention shortly about the relationship with MECP2 mutation, but it's not required to have a MECP2 mutation for the diagnosis. It's relatively common, as you can see, particularly among the causes of intellectual disability in females. And it has a trajectory that is characterized by variable level of normal development, followed by a very characteristic and basic requirement, essential requirement in terms of diagnosis of developmental regression. In that particular period is when the social communication impairment does exist, and that's a time when some of the girls meet diagnostic criteria for autism spectrum disorder. After that period, there's a stabilization of a variety of social functions, including the social function. You don't need to read that. It's simply to emphasize that this is a dynamic disorder that goes through stages, and several attempts have been made at characterizing these stages. I want to mention that this is the work that Ben Hagberg, who really pioneered the recognition of the disorder. This disorder was actually, next year is going to be 50 years since the initial description in the German literature, but it wasn't until 1983 when Ben Hagberg, in a very generous recognition of the initial work by Andrea Redd, described this condition. So we have had about 30 years of work in this disorder. As I mentioned before, regression, loss of developmental skill is the basic developmental diagnostic requirement, and you can see there that this loss of skill is characteristic in terms of being hand function and expressive language. In addition to that, the other two diagnostic criteria which are essential for the diagnosis of classic Rett syndrome are the abnormal gait and the very characteristic and almost symbolic stereotypic hand movements. Now, this is to show you that a girl after that period of regression actually has a remarkably good eye contact. And actually, one of the associate features of Rett syndrome is having this piercing eye gaze. Now, Rett syndrome, as I mentioned, was recognized since the 80s. And before the identification of the gene in 1999, mainly by the group of Dr. Huda Sagby at Baylor, with contribution from the Uta Franke at Stanford, we knew actually quite a bit about the characteristics of Rett syndrome on the basis of postmortem studies, as well as the studies of biological samples like CSF. And here you can see some of our early work on demonstrating that this was a synaptic disorder. I think there is no question about that. Everyone agrees that autism spectrum disorder is one type of synaptic disorder, and these are this is staining for MAP2, and you can see the cells are smaller, they have less well-defined and long, well-developed dendritic arborizations. Now, moving in the direction of neurobiology or neuropathological finding that can be used for development of treatment, I think one of the important findings is this finding involving NMDA receptor. And this is initially work from Mike Johnson's group at Kennedy Krieger Johns Hopkins, and showing that there is, particularly at early ages, there is a decrease in the density, and this is using receptor autoregulatory for receptors, increased binding during the early stages of the condition, and actually the opposite at later stages. The introduction of the mouse model led to the confirmation of this, and this is work that in which we collaborated with Mike's group, showing that during the early stages of development, there is increased density of NMDA receptor, whether you measure by receptor autoradiography or Western blots, and actually a decrease later in life. And we have also shown by in vivo MR spectroscopy that is increased also in glutamine, in free glutamine. So there is definitely here a potential target, and this is one that has been explored, and it's still under examination by the group at Hopkins, led by Sako Naidoo, and specifically using the dextromethorphan as an NMDA receptor antagonist. Other trials were based on a variety of sources of information, including those that I mentioned before, postmortem samples. So there were so many trials done by the early 2000s that Alan Percy, who was one of the pioneers in this area, published a review on the subject. Unfortunately, if you can summarize all those early trials, they were inconclusive or inconsistent results, some of them contradicting follow-up trials, contradicted the initial ones. And like with when you have this type of information in trial, it's very difficult to determine what was the problem, whether it's a study design, outcome measures, so on. But I think this was a combination of all those factors. A new era began in at the end of 1999 when, as I mentioned before, it was published that most cases of Rett syndrome were associated with mutations involving MECP2 or MECP2. And here you can see the structure of the gene. MECP2, the gene codes for a protein that is involved in transcription regulation, is mainly considered transcription repressor, but that seems to be an oversimplification of what MECP2 does. Here some are two of the main functional domains of the protein, the MBD domain by which MECP2 binds methylated DNA, although it does also bind unmethylated. And after this binding takes place, another functional domain of the protein attracts a transcription repressor complex, which includes histone deacetylases 1 and 2, and that's a TRD, which is located specifically in this place. And embedded in within the TRD is the nucleic localization signal. As you can see, even though we have more than 200 different mutations involving MECP2, 10 of them are the most frequent, and they tend to be concentrated in these functional domains as well as in the C-terminal region, which seems to be important for the stability and overall configuration of the protein. Now, why is this important? It's important because the evolution, the natural history of each of the disease is influenced by the type of mutation. So we have now a specific profile. This is one of our first attempts with the Australian group to characterize genotype-phenotype correlation. We published last year a larger study, with the first one with longitudinal data, and actually we can begin to mention or to talk about specific profile for specific mutations. Now, what's the connection with new treatments? I think that in the same way that the mGluR hypothesis has been the dominant one in Fragile X, the study of IGF-1 has been the mGluR equivalent in Rett syndrome. I mentioned before there were a number of studies and some ongoing based on the early neurobiology of Rett syndrome, but IGF-1 is paving the way to the new era of treatments in Rett syndrome. And I'm going to mention a little bit more about IGF-1 since the following talk is on the subject. So it's interesting that, and I think it raises one of the major issues, how much do you need to know about a treatment or a potential drug to use it? Actually, we know quite a bit about IGF-1, this growth factor, which obviously, as the name suggests, insulin-like growth factor has insulin-like properties. It binds its own receptor, it binds the receptor of IGF-2, but also it binds with relatively high affinity the insulin receptor. It's a growth factor, it has anabolic effects, and it's important for growth and in general. So we know mainly about the role of IGF-1 in the periphery. It's produced by the liver, and it's a very tightly regulated protein, as you could imagine, a protein that has so many actions and some that could be bad actions, has a tight regulation by two mechanisms. One, by binding proteins. There are five of them. The main one is the binding protein number 3, but also is cleaved. And we know the cleavage mainly in the periphery. I don't think that we know very well what happened in the brain. And that produces a compound, which is the N-terminus of the protein, which is made of 3 amino acid, glycine, proline, and glutamate, which is an active N-terminal peptide. It is known that in addition to binding to IGF receptor, and by virtue of that, activates at least two major pathways, which had been mentioned here in the previous talks. One is the PI3 kinase AKT kinase pathway, which connects with mTOR, and the MAP kinase pathway that seem to be involved in everything that we look at. Is important for promotion in terms of neurobiology. We know that promotes neuron survival, but it's also involved, as you could imagine, in synaptic plasticity and maturation, particularly having a major role with excitatory synapses. More recently, Daniela Tropia, who used to work in as a postdoc in Brigham Kassou's laboratory, published a paper about the potential role of IGF-1, particularly the tripeptide in glial activation, particularly in terms of the AKT pathway. So the first connection with Rett syndrome was that actually these IGF-binding proteins actually bind MECP2. So by virtue of having less MECP2 or less active MECP2, this IGF-BP binding will lead eventually to a decrease in the availability of IGF-1. So if you provide exogenous IGF-1, you will correct this defect. Now, IGF-1 is seen as a surrogate of BDNF, and I don't need to tell you the role of the importance of BDNF in almost anything that has to do with synaptic plasticity. And there is increasing evidence that IGF-1 is a good way to deliver BDNF-like growth factor properties. BDNF, unfortunately, doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. There is an active program in development of BDNF mimetics. Some are available. Some have been tried in other neurologic disorders, but it's still too early. So IGF-1 in a full-length form, and as well as in the tripeptide, does cross the blood-brain barrier, so it can be delivered. And one of the advantages that led to the development of this as a source of treatment is that IGF-1 has been already FDA approved as the treatment of the primary growth deficiency due to IGF-1 deficit. So the essential work in terms of validation IGF-1 as a treatment in Rett syndrome and eventually for other disorders, I think, it came from Brigham Kassou's laboratory. These are the two major papers. The 2009 paper is the one that opened the field. And this is a demonstration of how IGF-1 corrects a number of phenotypes that are well-recognized as phenotypes of importance in Rett syndrome. And in the same way that we have phenotypes that really we have used to characterize potential treatments in Fragile X, so you have a menu of 10 or so phenotypes that are critical. So I mentioned before, but BDNF is what we have been thinking about being the key factor for the neurobiology of Rett syndrome and other developmental disorders. If we cannot deliver it, IGF-1 could be a solution. And this is evidence coming from Rudolf Janicki's laboratory at MIT, showing that if you use these human neurons derived from embryonic stem cells, if you make them or these cells are deficient in MECP2 and you treat them either with IGF-1 or BDNF, you get the same rescue of the dendritic phenotype, the one that I mentioned before. So actually IGF-1 in a dish, at least, giving IGF-1 to a cell is equivalent to giving BDNF. So all of that gives a very strong rationale for developing clinical trials using IGF-1 in Rett syndrome. And this is work that was pioneered, as I mentioned before, by Mirigan Kassour and by Omar Kwaya at Boston Children's. I was simply arrived there. This was had already begun. I took it from where it was, the phase one trial, and then I designed and I started the phase two. So these are where we are right now. The phase one clinical trial, which like any phase one trial, focus on safety and other key elements like pharmacokinetics, was completed in 2012. It built into that phase one study, there was a period open label. Every subject, every patient received IGF-1, and even though everyone was knowing that IGF-1 was administered, it was a way to see potential efficacy of IGF-1. And that established the foundation for the design of the phase two trial. The phase two, which is still going on, is a crossover design with two periods of 20 weeks based on this open label extension, which show that actually to see efficacy, probably at least for some parameters, you need that length of time. And it's 20 weeks each. And everyone gets the drug, which is very important for developmental disorder. The parents really don't like parallel design. And there is a period of washout that unfortunately is very long for reasons that are beyond the initial plans. So what we learned from the phase one study is that the drug is, which is administered subcutaneously twice a day, is actually well tolerated. It's amazing how well the parents do the job. They learn, and there are no complications of administration of something that is injected. There were no serious adverse events related to the study, to the administration of the drug, and there were two potential efficacy effects. One was on anxiety and social avoidance behavior, and the other one on breath holding. Actually, it was very specific to breath holding, and as I'm going to show you shortly. So this is the type of rating scale that we use, and one on the left, RSBQ, is specific to Rett syndrome. The ADAM was developed for intellectual disability in general. It has been used in Fragile X, as you know, and it has the potential of being used in other disorders. These were mild improvements over time, and what you can see is the comparison between the beginning of this open label 20-week period and the end. Now, you can say that's not very impressive. Everyone was receiving the drug. So, you know, what's the big deal? I think the big deal comes not from so much from that, but from the fact that we have a biomarker linked to these rating scale findings. And I had to acknowledge that this is really the work of Chuck Nelson, and I am so grateful to him. This was the best present that I got in 2012, and it was a surprise. He kept the data until he could tell me, for sure whether he had data that could be analyzed. So unfortunately, because this patient had seizures and because there are motion artifacts, we didn't have actually data on everyone who was on that, but we had on enough subjects to have some idea. These six subjects, maybe there was something there. This frontal alpha band asymmetry index is one of the oldest indices or biomarkers of anxiety and mood disorders that have been published. It has been known for about 30 years, and it has been replicated in typically developing children. There are a wide range of situations in which this has been demonstrated. When you have the right side greater than the left in terms of the ratio, is linked to these two behavioral syndromes or abnormalities. And you can see most of the subjects at the beginning of the trial, at the beginning of this open label extension, had in blue a negative index. It was greater the right side. But after the administration, at the end of the administration period, either this negativity had decreased or it had been reversed completely. And this was correlated with the improvements in the rating scale. So this is, we can see, was very suggestive, powerful data. And going with the theme of how important is a biomarker, I was so glad that Jeremy mentioned that before. Another way to measure breathing is using plethysmography, and this is the setup we use. And using plethysmography, because I came to tell you, the clinical impression of whether it's breath holding or hyperventilation is very inconsistent, is very unreliable. We demonstrated there was a selective effect on breath holding. And this is improved dramatically, whether it was for those individuals who had breath holding considered clinically significant according to an adaptation of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine guidelines, or they were below that threshold but they still had episodes of breath holding. All of the entire cohort improved significantly. Now, that's what we learned, and that's what we're trying to replicate and to see whether there are other potential effects of IGF-1 in this phase two trial. It's blinded, so I cannot tell you where are we, because we are still going on. But I want to mention that the tripeptide also has been tried in clinical trials in Rett syndrome, and this is a work done by Neuren. And this is the IGF-1 tripeptide. And the type was very different in design to ours. It was a parallel design, so there was a group receiving the drug and then we were on placebo. There were a couple of different doses, so only the high dose that is also administered BIV, but fortunately orally, actually showed an improvement in these measures that I am mentioning here. The improvement was very non-specific, because as you can see, these measures are global measures, so measure behavior, autonomic function, and number of even GI symptoms. We cannot say that a particular set of symptoms improved, but overall there was an improvement. And these were mild, so actually the way that this became significant is by a combination of rating by the examiner and rating by the family. So it's a complex design that, if you're interested, I can discuss later. The FDA definitely said that this is not a breakthrough, but that this is something of intriguing to pursue further in phase 3 trials. So where are we right now in Rett syndrome? Where we are is that that mouse model, like in Fragile X and tuberous sclerosis, have allowed to enter a new era. And the mouse models are possible because we know the gene underlying the disorder. And now we have the possibility of using iPS cells, a stem cell, to do in vitro assessment and to screen for drugs. We have significant gaps of knowledge about the mechanism underlying this potential treatment, but do we need to know everything to start a trial? Probably not. And that's something that is interesting to discuss. Now, we started us in Fragile X, although I have to say that we knew what was going on in Fragile X. We knew the peaks and valleys of the story of Fragile X, that by the time that these things were in motion, the idea of curing, reversing completely the phenotype like you can do in a mouse, doing it in humans, I think that it was no longer the goal. So it seemed to be at this point that what we can do is to ameliorate the phenotype. Cure is always what we want to achieve. And it seemed to be that despite the correction of the phenotypes in the mouse, it's global. In patients, it's only selective. Only a few phenotypes can be corrected. So I think the big question for all these studies is, how can we make the drug development shorter? And how can we avoid to get to an advanced phase 2 or phase 3 and say, oh, it didn't work? And how can we go back and to have more effective ways to make sure that we're on the right track? I don't think anyone has a solution about this, but I think this is one of the key questions in the field. And it's not only about Rett syndrome, but also about neurodevelopmental disorder in general. Now, biomarkers. I don't think that you will leave this session without thinking that we need more. We need better outcome measure, we need better biomarkers. And the story of Rett syndrome re-emphasizes that. And also, we have begun to consider the possibility of combining this with learning intervention, what we are trying to do also in Fragile X. And something that nobody mentioned, but we have had the problem. When you do long trials, a lot of things can happen. And you know what can happen? It's new social media. It could be your best friend to recruit. It could be your worst enemy. And particularly when the parents tell others how to answer the screening instruments or pre-screening instruments. There are many ways, and we have gone through that in Fragile X. So all these placebo ins, and there are many ways to compensate for that, but keep that in mind. It's a big concern of the FDA right now. And I want to close showing something that is promising, because I don't want to leave you depressed, is that development of biomarkers is a possibility, and we need to use technology. And this is an example of what we can do for the stereotypic hand movements in Rett syndrome. They are very complex. There are multiple types, and the one that almost everyone knows is the hand wringing, hand washing, but there are others. And this is an example of a patient with asymmetric stereotypy. The left hand seems to be passive in the mouth, and the right hand is tapping. It seems to be the active one. So we can, in an objective way, not only based on power of observation, we can tell you what seemed to be the trigger. It seemed to be that this is the one by looking at amplitude and temporal correlations. And also we can even do something more fancy. I know everyone had to show a movie, something attractive. And this is a movie showing a 3D reconstruction of the area covered by each hand. So if you wanted to measure effectiveness in treating hand stereotypy to improve hand function, probably in this case you would like to treat only the green hand. That's the problem. So closing this, there are so many people that I need to acknowledge. This is a short list. And I want to make a particular mention of the support of the Department of Neurology at Children's Hospital for these two trials. This is a unique institutional commitment to a particular type of research. And like in anyone who does clinical trial know, you really need to be for the long run, and you need to have very, very strong temperament, because this is really a difficult field. Problems are going to happen, big problems most likely are going to happen. So you need to be for the long run, and you need to have institutional support for this. So I want to thank also the funding agents and everyone who has participated. The team here is on the who started everything even before my arrival is depicted there. Thanks very much.